Anna and Monica for organizing this conference and for inviting me here. And the second thing I'd like to say is that I'm going to be going way too quickly. The complete text of these slides is available at my webpage and also the papers that this is based on. And third of all, this work was done when I was on research leave at Wesleyan University last year. So I'll start by briefly reviewing what a cellular automaton is. So a cellular automaton, I think of it as basically being like the discrete version of a partial differential equation. So like a partial differential equation, it's a dynamical system which is sort of spatially distributed. The difference is that now space is a discrete lattice, and the local state at each point is not a real number. It's an element of a finite alphabet, which we call A. So the global state is basically an assignment of a letter in A to each point in the lattice. In the set of all such configurations, configuration space, we write like this. So a typical element of configuration space I'll write as a bold-faced A in matrix notation. So the cellular automaton is a transformation from configuration space to itself, which you obtain in the following way. You define, first of all, you identify some finite subset of the lattice, which we can sort of think of as a neighborhood of the origin. So here's a picture. So A to the K is a set of all assignments of letters to each letter to each point in this neighborhood K. And you have a local rule, small phi, which takes such a K block and assigns a new letter to it. And what you do is you start with some initial configuration at time zero. And at each lattice point, you look in the K neighborhood of that lattice point. You evaluate this rule phi, and you get a new letter, which you put at that lattice point. And so if you do this at each point in the lattice, you transform your configuration at time zero into a new configuration at time one. And that defines a function phi from configuration space to itself. And that is the cellular automaton. So here's a simple example. So in this case, we're looking at a one-dimensional cellular automaton on a two-letter alphabet, 0 and 1. And my neighborhood is basically just 0 and its two nearest neighbors. So this means that my local rule is going to be a function which takes three tuples of zeros and ones and produces a single 0 or 1 as output. So don't bother looking at these equations. Instead, look at this. So basically, this is a space-time diagram, which is how we visualize the dynamics of these things. So the way this works is each row of this diagram corresponds to the state of the system at some moment in time. So the top row is a state at time 0, which is some sequence of zeros and ones. Then you apply the dynamics, and the second row is the state of the system at time 1, and the third row is the state of the system at time 2, etc. And as you march down the page, you move forward in time. And so when you look at this, you don't really, it doesn't really look like very much. It basically looks like a big mess. However, if we zoom out, if you look at the same picture on a much larger scale, some kind of order starts to emerge. And so what you basically see now is that there's a kind of a regular back, starting from a random initial condition at the top, the system rapidly converges to a regular background pattern, which up close looks like this. And that regular background pattern is interrupted by certain sort of propagating defects or sort of disturbances. And you can see that, remember this is a space-time diagram. So for example, this diagonal line here indicates some disturbance which is propagating through space at a constant velocity. And if you look at this picture up close, you see that there are basically three kinds of disturbances, which are normally called alpha, beta, and gamma. So the alpha and beta disturbances are stationary, and the gamma disturbance moves through space at a constant speed. And there are interactions which occur when these defects collide with each other. So, for example, here a gamma defect collides with an alpha defect and annihilates the alpha defect and keeps going. Here is a place where a gamma defect collides with a beta defect, and they combine and become an alpha defect. Okay. So there are sort of many known examples of these things, even in simple cellular automata. Here's another example, elementary cellular automata 184. So once again, from a random initial condition, you converge rapidly to a very simple background. In this case, it's a checkerboard. And you can see that there are a number of different sort of defects that you see, and they move through space and collide. So for example, right here is a place where this kind of black defect moving in this direction hits a white defect moving in the other direction, and they annihilate. And here's another example. This is elementary cellular automaton 54. Now it's a little bit more complicated, but in this case you can see there's a regular background pattern which looks like this, and there are basically four distinct kinds of defects which basically propagate and collide and interact in complicated ways. And I could go on, but let's keep going. So what you notice in these examples is that there's a kind of a defect particle chemistry, so to speak, meaning that when defects collide, they interact and combine in predictable ways. And you can write these little reaction equations. So in our first example, for example, we had a gamma particle hit a beta particle, and they combine to make an alpha particle. Or a gamma particle hits an alpha particle and annihilates it. In the second example, these two particles coming in opposite directions collided and annihilated with each other, etc. And in the third example, there were other defect chemical interactions. So these things have been studied empirically since the early 80s by people like Grassberger and Wolfram and Lind and Bukhara, Nasser, Rogers, etc. But there hasn't really been a lot of theoretical work done on these things. The only theoretical work I know of is that in the early 90s, Eloranta, Kurka, and Mass basically looked at the motion of certain defects and noticed that it followed a random walk. And also recently, Wolfram and Cook studied one particular cellular automaton and showed that it basically implemented universal computation. So there are a lot of interesting theoretical questions one could ask about these things. So for example, maybe I should just throw them on the floor and skip the middleman. Thank you. For starters, you could ask, well, is there some sort of algebraic structure which is governing this defect chemistry? So what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is this. When you look at sort of real chemistry, there are certain physical quantities which are conserved in chemical interactions, physical quantities like charge and mass. And you can use the conservation of those quantities to help predict the outcome of chemical interactions. So would it be possible to assign certain algebraic properties to defects which would be conserved in the same way? Second of all, why do these defects persist over time? I mean, if you notice in these examples I showed you earlier, the cellular automaton rapidly changes most of the state space into this regular background pattern, and yet it can't get rid of these defects. Now, maybe the reason is because the defects have these conserved algebraic quantities, some kind of abstract charge, and the cellular automaton has to conserve charge, so it can't destroy the defect. And third of all, is there some kind of laws of motion by which the defects propagate through space? So in one-dimensional cellular automata, these questions have fairly satisfactory answers. So I'm not going to talk about that because I want to get to higher dimensional stuff. So basically, let's fix some dimension d greater than, I guess it could be 1. But in general, it's going to be 2 or greater. And we have some radius r greater than 0. B of r is going to be the box of side length 2r plus 1 in a d-dimensional lattice. So a to the br is the set of all assignments of letters to each point in this box. So in other words, all r blocks. So we're going to pick some subset, a sub r, of the set of r blocks. I'm going to call this a set of admissible r blocks. The subshift of finite type determined by a sub r is a set of all configurations in configuration space such that if you look at an r neighborhood of each lattice point, then the r block you see in an r neighborhood of that lattice point is a member of this admissible set. Okay? So if I have a configuration and I look at a lattice point and in an r neighborhood of that lattice point it is not part of that admissible set, then I say that A is defective at that lattice point, and the defect set of A is a set of all lattice points where it's defective. If I have a cellular automaton, I say that the subshift is invariant into the cellular automaton if phi maps A back into itself. And under these conditions, if a configuration has defects, then empirically so does its image under the action of the cellular automaton. Okay, so now I introduce a technical condition. I will say that a configuration is finitely defective if the following is true. For any large r greater than 0, you can find some point in the lattice such that if you look in an r neighborhood around that point, everything you see is admissible. So what this means is that although the configuration A may contain large defects, even infinitely large defects, it also contains arbitrarily large non-defective regions. And this is important because we need this condition in order to be able to sort of meaningfully say that A is approximately an element of the subshift of finite type. If it was not finitely defective in this way, that would mean that it violates the conditions of the subshift so severely that it's really not useful to sort of compare it to elements of the subshift. So this means that we can at least get information about A by comparing it to elements of the subshift. Okay? So let A tilde be the set of finitely defective elements. Obviously, when I say defective, I mean with respect to the subshift A. And it's easy to show that if phi maps A into itself, then phi also maps A tilde into itself. Furthermore, if A is a finitely defective configuration, then the defects in the image of A will be close to the defects in A, in the sense that, you know, they move sort of a little bit through the space or change shape, but they don't really change radically. Okay. Now, it will be useful for us to sort of talk about the topological properties of the defect set. Now, of course, this is complicated by the fact that the defect set is a subset of a lattice, and so it's discrete, so it has no interesting topology. So what I want to do is approximate it with a nice subset of Euclidean space. So let hollow G of A be the set of all lattice points where A is not defective. So I'm going to fill that set out. So solid G of A is the union of all unit cubes whose corner vertices are in hollow G of A. So this is some contiguous subset of Euclidean space, which is sort of a topological approximation of this set. So I say that the defect in A is a domain boundary if this set is disconnected. So here's a simple example, the monochromatic shift. So here my alphabet consists of two letters, black square and white square, and the rule that defines my subshift is that no black square can be adjacent to a white square. And here's a configuration which has a domain boundary defect. So the top half is admissible, it's all black, the bottom half is admissible, but the top and bottom halves are disconnected from one another by this jagged red line, which is the defect. Here's another example. This is the checkerboard shift. So once again, I've got a two-letter alphabet of black and white, and now the rule is that no square can be adjacent to another square of the same color. And here we see a defective configuration. The top half is an admissible checkerboard. The bottom half is an admissible checkerboard, but they're disconnected from one another by this defective, by this defect, this jagged red line down the middle. Okay, here are some slightly more complicated examples. The thing at the top is the square ice shift. So in this case, my alphabet consists of six symbols, which I will think of as square tiles with little notches and teeth on their edges. And the rule is basically you have to put the tiles together so that the notches and the teeth line up properly. And so here's an example of a defective configuration. The top half is admissible and the bottom half is admissible, but again, they're disconnected by this domain boundary, this defect in the middle. And another example at the bottom is the domino tiling. So in this case, I have an alphabet of four tiles with these notches on them. This is called dominoes because if you put these tiles together so that you satisfy these edge matching constraints, then you can interpret that as a tiling of the plane by dominoes in sort of the obvious way. And here are two defective configurations where, once again, I've got these domain boundaries. Okay. I say that if A is a defective configuration and phi is a cellular automaton which preserves the subshift of finite type, then I'll say that the defect in A is phi persistent if all the forward-time iterates of A also have a defect. So all of the space-time diagrams I showed you earlier of those one-dimensional cellular automata were examples of persistent defects, right? You can see the defect persisting over time. Maybe it moves around or something, but it basically stays there. But of course, that's an empirical observation. It would be nice if we had some kind of theoretical justification for why we observe this. So a closely related idea is the idea of an essential defect. So I'm going to say that a defect is essential if it cannot be removed through a local change. So in other words, I have a defect. If I modify the configuration in any finite region around that defect, I cannot make the defect go away. I might be able to move it around or change its shape, but I cannot destroy it. So for example, here, I've got a transition from an all-white region to an all-black region, and basically no matter what I do, no matter how I change the configuration in the center here, I cannot get rid of the fact that I'm going from an all-white region to an all-black region. I can never destroy this defect. Here, the problem is that the top checkerboard is one half period out of phase with the bottom checkerboard. And no matter how I try to change things in the neighborhood of this defect, I cannot change the fact that the top half is out of phase with the bottom half. These three examples here, if you play with them for a while, you will convince yourself that these are also essential defects. But it's not really clear why that should be the case. So the first two examples, you can basically understand what's going on here using spectral theory. I mean, I already sort of alluded to it with this talk about periods. But once again, that's something I'm not going to get into much detail about because I don't have time. Instead, I'm going to look at these examples, which cannot be explained using spectral theory. In order to understand those examples, you need to use cohomology. So let's suppose that G is a discrete group. Okay, a G-valued cocycle is a function which takes an element, a configuration in my subshift, and a point in the lattice, and combines them and assigns to them an element in the group G. And it has to satisfy this equation called the cocycle equation. Rather than explaining that equation, I'll basically just look at a simple example. So in this example, we're looking at the square ice subshift, okay? And our group is going to be the integer. So this is an integer-valued cocycle. And I'm going to define it using two local rules, C1 and C2. So these guys take a single tile, okay, and they assign it either a plus or minus 1 according to the following conditions. So C1 looks at the bottom edge of the tile. Okay, the southern edge. If the southern edge points north, then it gives it a plus 1. And if the southern edge points south, it gives it a minus 1. C2 looks at the western edge, and if it sees a western pointing tooth, it gives it a plus 1. And if the western edge points east, it gives it a minus 1. Now, you define a cocycle in the following way. Given any configuration in square ice and any point z in the lattice, you start at 0, you walk along a path from 0 up to z, you look at all the edges you see of the tiles that you cross along that path, and you count the number of notches in which direction they're pointing, and assign them a plus or minus 1, you add all those things up, you get an integer. And that gives you a function, and that value actually is independent of the choice of path that you use to get from 0 to z, and that's an integer-valued cocycle. Integer valued cocycles are often called height functions because the idea is that given any configuration, what you're effectively doing is assigning an integer valued height to each point in the lattice. So you can sort of visualize your configuration as a kind of a three-dimensional landscape, okay? And that will be useful to us later. Okay. In the case of dominoes, there are no integer valued cocycles, but instead we have a cocycle taking values in this non-abelian group. So this is a free product of two copies of the cyclic group of order 2. So in other words, it's a group whose elements look like this. They're products of V and H, where V and H are non-commuting elements, each have order 2. So now I define a cocycle in the same way. Again, I've got two local rules, which basically look at the edges of tiles and basically assign them words according to these rules. Okay? And now basically starting at 0, I walk along a path towards Z, and I look at the edges of the tiles I see along that path, and I multiply these words together, and I get this non-commuting product here. Okay, and that gives me the value of the cocycle at Z. And once again, even though this is a non-commuting product, actually this value is independent of the choice of path I used to get from 0 to Z. Okay, two cocycles are called cohomologous if you can get from one to the other by multiplying by this transfer function like this. So, for example, in the case of a height function, that loosely speaking means that the two cocycles kind of differ by a constant or something like that, okay? So basically, with that in place, let Z1 be the set of all cocycles, and let H1 be the set of all cohomology equivalence classes. Now, if G is an abelian group, then Z1 is a group under pointwise addition. The product of any two cocycles will also be a cocycle. And H1 is a quotient group, which predictably is called the first cohomology group. If G is not abelian, then Z1 and H1 are not groups, but they're still well-defined as sets, and we still use this terminology. Okay, now, on the previous slide, you saw that I defined cocycles basically by sort of in some sense summing values along a path. So now I want to make that idea a little bit more formal. So let E be the set of nearest neighbors of the origin in a d-dimensional lattice. Okay, a trail is a sequence of lattice points such that the difference between any two consecutive lattice points is an element of E. In other words, it's a sequence of lattice points, each one of which is adjacent to the previous one. Okay, now suppose that I have a local rule C. So C takes an element of my nearest neighbor set E, and a R block in my an admissible R block in my subshift, and assigns to them a letter G. And it has to satisfy the following two equations. Once again, instead of reading out the equations, I'll simply explain what they mean with these little pictures here. So the first equation is kind of a commuting diagram equation. It basically says, if I evaluate the cocycle going up and then evaluate it going to the right, I get the same thing as if I would evaluate it going to the right and then going up. The second equation says, if I evaluate the cocycle going down, I get the inverse of whatever I would get if I evaluated going up, and likewise for any other pair of opposite directions. Okay? Now, given any trail zeta, I define in some sense the integral of the local rule C along zeta for some configuration A, basically by this formula. So in other words, I take the product of the values of the local rule along each step of the trail zeta. Okay? And if the local rule satisfies these two equations, then this product depends only upon the starting point and end point of the trail. It does not depend on the actual trail itself. So in particular, that means that if zeta was a closed trail, which started and ended at the same point, then this value would always be equal to the identity element of my group. Okay? So now, with this in place, I can define a cocycle in the following way. For any configuration in my subshift and any point in the lattice, I define the value of the cocycle at Z to just be the integral of the local rule along zeta, where zeta is any trail that goes from the origin to Z. And like I said, that's well-defined, independent of the choice of zeta. So in this case, I said that my cocycle C is locally determined. And if I'm dealing with a discrete group, then every cocycle is locally determined in this fashion. Okay, what does this have to do with cellular automata? Well, supposing phi is a cellular automaton which preserves the subshift A, if C is a cocycle, I can get a new cocycle, phi star C, by precomposing C with phi in the obvious way. Furthermore, if C is locally determined, then phi star C is also locally determined. Third of all, if C and C prime are cohomologous, then their phi star images are also cohomologous, and thus phi induces a function on the set of cohomology classes. And fourth, if the group is abelian, then phi star is in fact a group endomorphism. Okay, and now I'll ask a question which I don't know the answer to. For a lot of what I'm about to do, it's important to know when this function is surjective. And I actually do not know yet under what conditions the function phi star is surjective on the set of cohomology classes. So that's an interesting question. Okay. So now, I'll talk about a particular class of defect which can be understood using this cohomology machinery. I call these things gaps. So rather than giving you the formal definition, I'll look at an example. So here is the domain boundary defect which I showed you earlier in square ice. Okay.
and I'm going to take the integer-valued cocycle, which I earlier defined for square ice, and I'm going to evaluate it on this configuration. And, I'm going to interpret it literally as a height function, in the sense that I'm going to basically make a three-dimensional graph, or I'm going to interpret this configuration as a landscape. And you can see immediately what happens. The southern connected component, if I evaluate this height function, is sloping downwards, whereas the northern connected component is sloping upwards. And indeed, if you were to walk along this blue path of y's here, and you were to walk along the red path of x's here, you would find that the height difference between them becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And what that tells you is that if I try to sort of repave the central region of this landscape, there is no way that I could repave it that would get rid of that asymptotic divergence in the height of the northern half and the southern half. That tells you that this defect is essential. I cannot get rid of it. Okay? So that is what I mean when I talk about a gap. So here's another example of a gap in dominoes. Okay, in the case of dominoes, it's a little bit more complicated because, of course, the cocycle in dominoes is not integer valued, but we can turn it into an integer valued cocycle by basically grouping together 2x2 blocks of cells. And if we do that, then the two examples of domain boundaries that I showed you in dominoes also exhibit this property of being a gap. So for example, in this example here, the southern connected component is flat, whereas the northern connected component is sloping upwards. In this example, the western connected component is sloping upwards, and the eastern connected component is sloping downwards. And again, that tells you that this domain boundary between them is essential. You cannot get rid of it through any amount of finite change. Okay, with that in place, it's possible to show the following theorem. If phi is a cellular automaton which preserves the subshift of finite type, and the induced endomorphism on the cohomology group, on the integer valued cohomology group, is surjective, then any gap is persistent. In other words, for example, if I look at the square ice shift, and I look at that gap I showed you in square ice, okay, and there's some cellular automaton which preserves square ice and is surjective on the set of height functions, then it cannot get rid of that gap. It might be able to sort of move it around or change its shape, but it cannot destroy the gap. Okay, and of course there's no time to go into the proof, so let's just keep going. Domain boundaries are what I call defects of codimension 1. So topologically speaking, they disconnect the space. But it's also interesting to look at defects of higher codimension. So without getting to too much technicalities, the idea is basically this. If you look at the non-defective region of the space and you treat it as some subset of Euclidean space, then you can look at the homotopy groups of that subset of Euclidean space. So for example, look at this configuration here. It has a red defect in the middle. This is a configuration in square ice. It has a red defect in the middle, which in some sense is kind of like a little hole. Okay? So if I put a base point here and I drew a path that went around that hole, then it would not be possible to null homotope that path without passing it through the hole. So that means that the fundamental group of the non-defective part of the space is non-trivial. So I say that the configuration A has a defect of codimension 1 if the fundamental group of the non-defective region is non-trivial. So this is, codimension 2 rather. So this is a codimension 2 defect in square ice, and here's an example of a codimension 2 defect in the domino tiling. So earlier I talked about how you could sort of think about cocycles as being something you obtain by integrating along paths. Okay. So now I'm gonna sort of look at that idea in more detail. So I'm going to say that two trails are homotopic if you can get from one trail to the other through a sequence of sort of deformations like this. So, you know, for example, here the blue trail is homotopic to the red trail because you can sort of get from one to the other by changing them on a single square. So this gives you a concept of homotopy classes of trails. And it's not hard to see that any homotopy class of loops in the non-defective part of the configuration can be represented by some homotopy class of trails. So you can think of the fundamental group as really being the group of all homotopy classes of trails. Now, if I have a cocycle C and a defective configuration A, and I have a closed trail zeta in the non-defective part of A, then I can integrate the cocycle on that closed trail, okay? And it's possible to show that if zeta is homotopic to zeta prime, then the integrals of the cocycles on these two different trails are equal to each other. In particular, if zeta is null homotopic in the non-defective part, in other words, you can shrink it down to nothing without passing through any defects, then the value of the cocycle must be equal to the identity element. Okay? Furthermore, if the group G is abelian and two cocycles are cohomologous, then their integrals on every trail will be the same. So, this means that if I have a cocycle and I evaluate it on a trail and I get a closed trail and I get a non-zero value, that means that that trail is going around some kind of defect, And furthermore, that defect is somehow ineradicable. Okay? So this, to me, reminds me of the idea of taking a path integral on a complex analytic function around a pole. If you've got some kind of singularity, and you take a path that goes around that singularity, and you integrate along that path, and you get a non-zero value, you call that a residue, and that means that what you have is a pole. It is not a removable singularity. It is an essential property of the analytic function in question. And so for that reason, I say that the configuration A has a C pole if the integral of C along zeta is not equal to the identity for some closed trail in the homotopy group. So here's an example. This is the pole. This is the defect I showed you in square ice earlier. Here's a trail that goes around that defect, and I'm basically evaluating the height function I showed you earlier. You add up all the plus ones and minus ones, and you get 8. And basically, since this is a homotopy invariant, that means no matter how big I make this loop, as long as it goes around this pole once, I will get 8. And that means that basically no matter how large a region I try to change this hole in, I will not be able to get rid of the hole. So that tells you that hole is an essential defect. So that's the first statement here. G poles are essential defects. But furthermore, once again, if I have a cellular automaton which preserves the subshift and it acts surjectively on the set of cohomology on the set of cohomology classes of cocycles, then all G poles will be fee persistent. Okay. So for example, in the previous slide, that picture of the pole in ice, that would be persistent under the action of any cellular automaton which preserved square ice and which was surjective on a set of homotopy on a set of cocycles. So we can generalize these ideas to higher dimensions as well. So this is, in some sense, the three-dimensional analog of square ice. So I call this ice cube. So here's an example of a codimension 1 defect. So here the red spheres represent the defective part, and so you can see that they kind of act as a domain boundary and cut the space in half. Here's a codimension 2 defect. So it's some kind of a line, and of course you can put paths around it which are non-null homotopic. And here's a codimension 3 defect. So in this case, it's the second homotopy group. It is pi 2, which is non-trivial. And you can generalize the theory I previously had to this kind of example here and talk about sort of higher dimensional cocycles which you integrate on spheres which go around that pole. And I think I'm probably out of time, yes, or close to it. So what I will do is just briefly allude to how this is related to another way of thinking about defects in subshifts, and that is something called the Conway-Lagarias tiling group. So the idea of the Conway-Lagarias tiling group is this. So in all the previous examples, by the way, I sort of my subshifts of finite type, I visualize them using sort of sets of tiles. And indeed, you can always do that. You can always code a subshift of finite type as a set of tiles. Okay? So imagine I had a set of tiles. Okay? I can use those to build a tile complex. The idea is basically above every point in Euclidean space, I put copies of all of my tiles, and I basically glue them together using the obvious edge matching condition. So this is a sort of a small fragment of the tile complex for the domino tiling. Okay? So you can sort of think of this as kind of like a covering space of R2, although it's not really a covering space, but basically it's some kind of complicated cell complex. Okay? And so there's a natural projection which takes this space down into R2, and any tiling of the plane corresponds to a section of that projection, okay? A one-sided inverse of that projection map. So now, if you take any closed path in R2, that lifts up to a path inside this space up here, okay? And so if you look at the fundamental group of this space, if you look at the homotopy group of this space, the non-trivial elements of the homotopy group of this space represent paths going around essential defects in tilings of the plane. Okay, so in a sense, this the Conway-Lagarias tiling group can be thought of as a kind of a way of measuring all possible essential defects which could occur. And so the theory that I talked about for cellular automata, you can basically translate that into the language of the Conway-Lagarias group. Actually, it's a bit more complicated. You have to introduce something called the Geller-Prop projective homotopy group. But loosely speaking, the idea is that a cellular automaton induces a kind of a continuous transformation from this space into itself, which then induces a continuous homomorphism from the homotopy groups of this space into itself, and also, of course, the homology groups and the cohomology groups of this space into itself. And so those endomorphisms of the various algebraic invariant groups of this space provide you with another algebraic mechanism for detecting the existence of essential and persistent defects. Okay, so I think I'm out of time, so I'll stop there. So thank you very much.